We are going to dedicate the programme today to an interview that conducted with one of my old pals from this world, that being Christy Dignam. And Christy, very kindly, with Catherine, his wife, invited us to his house last week. We went over to have a chat for what he described as possibly his last interview. And I didn't like that description, because I've often said to Christy, we said it before a few times, we've often joked about him coming into the Late Late Show for the last time, about five times in a row. So I hope on this occasion he's wrong again. But for now, let me tell you that we did go out to his house, and he's a remarkable person. You would have seen him on TV or heard him on radio or bought his music or watched him on stage. And he is in fine fettle. I'm happy to report. And over coffee and probably about an hour in his front room of his house, we chatted about it all. And to give you a description, the front room of his house has now become his new bedroom, if you like. There's a hospital bed which he brought in, and he sits on that, on the side of that. He was wearing his hoodie and his jeans, and he looked like he might as well be going out to a gig, to be honest with you. He looked match fit. You might hear some different sounds on this interview. You might hear sounds of an occasional machine puffing away in a corner. You might hear Christy struggling for a little bit of breath on occasion, but not much. He seemed to be, as I say, in as good health as is possible. But most importantly, you'll hear an astute person, somebody who's thought about it all, somebody who's knocked on the door of death before, and somebody who has done essentially an audit of his life. And occasionally both our eyes would be drawn to the window out to his front garden and onto the estate he lives in, and watch the world go by looking very much alive. And we'd look at that and people passing by, and he'll talk about watching somebody passing by the window, put it into context in a few minutes' time. And the world would pass by oblivious to two men sitting in a front room talking about life, death, and the universe as he sees it. And then we'd return back to our conversation. And this is what our show is today. It's a chat between myself and Christy. As I say, somebody I've known for years, coming in and out of particularly the Late Late Show, but also this show. And every time we meet, we become a little bit closer. I don't want to overstate it, but I have great admiration for him. And I think a lot of people in this country, a lot of people listening in, have great love, appreciation for Christy Dignam. So at this point, I'll stop talking and we will all together go to Christy Dignam's front room and have a chat with the man himself. So here I am sitting in the Dignam household. Not my first time here, actually. I was here before.
Here a couple of times, yeah.
A couple of times. The last time I was here with you, the finches were going crazy out in the cages.
Yeah, I had to get rid of them because obviously I wasn't able to take care of them anymore.
How many did you have?
70 or 80 or something.
That many? Where did that come from?
Just starting to move into the house. Well, when I was a kid,
yeah,
I was always into boards, you know. And growing up in Fingus, when I started, Fingus was a village, do you know what I mean? It was out in the countryside.
Yeah.
So as kids, you go looking for board nests and all that. So that's where it all started. But I didn't like seeing them in cages. It's a horrible thing, you know.
Yeah.
I remember not being able to sing one time. I had a sore throat. And I remember thinking, this would be much better for the board if you take off its wings, you know.
Yeah.
So when you start getting thoughts like that, you can't really keep them anymore.
So they were gone. The birds have flown.
Yeah.
You've been unwell for a while now.
10 years.
Do you recall when the doctor said to you the first time and said, you know what, you're not well? Do you remember that? Or
I kept getting these chest infections.
Yeah.
And they kept giving me antibiotics, but the antibiotics weren't working. They just didn't seem to be doing the job. So I got an ambulance one day here. I could hardly breathe. Got an ambulance to Blanchardstown. So they've done a load of tests there. And then they sent me to Bowmount to do a couple of biopsies. So the doctor came in the day of the biopsies and he said, it might be bad news. He said, there's two cancers that resembles. He says, it's amyloidosis is one of them. Mm-hmm. And multiple myeloma is the other one, you know. So but we haven't, it could be neither. So you've kind of three options, you know. So you're like, okay, or you've got those two. So the next day he came in, I says, which one was it? He says, you have the two of them. I said, yeah. But I didn't, initially I rejected it, And I said to your man, I said, where do you go? He says, you go back to Trinity and give back your degrees. I said, you haven't a clue what you're talking about. I think anybody that's gotten a cancer diagnosis will understand that, denial, you know.
Yeah.
But I remember about 5 years prior to being diagnosed myself, I got a phone call, and I'd done this a good few times, but this time I had to go out to the hospice out in Raheny, and there was this 17-year-old kid there. And he was dying, and I went out, we'd done a couple of songs and blah, blah, blah. So I was on my way back to here, you know, so I was a 20-minute drive back to here. And I got a phone call off a sister halfway home, and I thought she was ringing me to thank me, you know, look, thanks. For, the chap had died just after we left it. So I started thinking of, he had 11 years of life, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I had, well, at the time I was 50 or something like that.
What did you do with it, with the diagnosis? Did you try to pretend it wasn't happening until you had to confront it?
Yeah, that's what I tried to. Initially, I was so ill I could not confront it. You know, it was, you know, sitting me in the face. But when you kind of got a handle on the medication and that and got stabilised the whole thing, I used to just pretend, but I'd live as if there was nothing wrong with me.
Yeah.
And then when something debilitated me, I'd deal with it on that day, do you know what I mean? And that's the way it's been.
We're in your front room today. We'll talk about that in a moment. But when I came through the door, obviously Catherine, your wife, said, she said, I hope she doesn't mind me saying, she said, he's like Lazarus in there, you know. And I was laughing because I think you were on the Late Late Show for the last time about 6 times.
I know, yeah.
Do you know what I mean by that?
I do, yeah. So people used to be on Facebook saying, he has shares in the Late Late Show. But honest to God, I got a few of them. But when we, for the last, we say, 2 or 3 years, it wasn't going right with us, man, you know. And we were turning into a band that I didn't want to be in, kind of thing. And that's why I ended up doing the solo album that time, because I think some of the lads would be happy to plod along and just keep doing the crazy world kind of thing, you know. And I wasn't really getting nothing out of that anymore, you know. So the band were kind of drifting apart. And I noticed a couple of the crew are starting to leave and stuff like that. So it just, I don't know. We had a guy called Sven, he was the manager, he was a Norwegian dude. And he had a farm in Norway, a timber farm.
Mm-hmm.
So we were playing a gig in Waterford, and he said, look, I'll fly over to Norway. He says, and I'll meet you at the weekend for the whatever we were playing that weekend. But when he was in Norway, he was killed in a fire. The yard kind of thing. So the wind turned towards his barn, and he was trying to put a brake line down, had a heart attack. But he was sitting in the smoke for kind of 20 minutes, and that's what killed him. So that was devastating to me, you know, because I really got on with this guy. And I always felt one of the things that held Aslan back was bad management.
Mm.
We never really got somebody that really was a good manager, you know. You see, now you look at young bands coming up, wild youth and stuff, and there's a hierarchy now, you know, it's been building over the last, sorry, I hit that twice. But when we were kind of grown up, there was none of that, you know what I mean? There was nobody there before us to kind of advise us and stuff like that.
Do you have any regrets about Aslan and the band?
No, I had a brilliant life with them, you know. And when it was good, it was absolutely amazing, you know.
You know, Christy, when somebody goes into palliative care, it, from my understanding of it, very few of them have
come
home.
Absolutely. Because I thought this is the conveyor belt up to heaven kind of thing, you know. So we'll go in here now and that'll be the end of it. But I found that, you know, that there are, I mean, there is that, but it's also there. See, the reason I done it was, I was staying here. Catherine has 10 brothers and sisters. I have 8 brothers and sisters. So they'd all be coming up to visit you. And in 1 week I got a conjunctivitis, a chest infection, a stomach bug. So they were bringing all these germs into the house. And also, you know, say there'll be a load of people, you're going to stay up and entertain them, you know, you're going to. And I was just exhausted with it. So going into respite, was to just get, to give me time to think as to what's the best way going forward. So now we really limit who comes to the house, you know.
So we're in your, it's essentially a television room with a view out onto the road in your estate here, and you've got, it's a medical bed, looks comfortable, as much as it can be in your couches. And then to my left is the kitchen table and Catherine looking in and beautiful garden. And it's, I can see why you'd want to come home, because it's not a house, it's a home.
Yeah, but you know what? I was sitting here one day and I was looking out the window. This was only about a couple of weeks ago. And this fella walked by the door, just walking by, you know. And I just looked at him and I thought, you'll never do that again. You'll never walk, just go for a walk, you know. And then that kind of sent me into a spiral. I started to think all the things I won't do again.
You thought to yourself, I can never do what that man's doing, which is simply just walking by your window. Road, yeah. And what does a spiral look like or feel like?
It's dark, is it? Nice. It's like you're kind of heading into an abyss, you know. And I wouldn't be huge at religious, you know. So the whole, I remember really admiring Catherine's man dad and my man dad, because they were kind of happily going to look at me. Lovely, you know, we've done the hard bit, now we're going to heaven. Yeah. I'd love to have that outlook, do you know what I mean?
But you don't have any of that faith, as a
logic just won't work with me.
Yeah, logic won't let that in.
No.
But like when I come in the door, I see two what looks like religious, almost Eastern Buddhist heads of some sort.
I believe I'm spiritual. I believe we're all spiritual beings, you know, in some sense or other. So I remember used to be an old saying when I was going to NA that religion is for people who want to go to heaven. Spirituality is for people who've been to hell. And I really identified with that, you know, because when you've had rough times, you see that the contrast is so vast that it helps you see the world in a more focused way, if you know what I mean.
Do you think about, have you been thinking about your life? What a full life you've lived so far. Do you let your mind drift into almost like a this is your life of the mind?
Yeah.
And what's jumping out?
Just fear, you know. Like nobody wants to die, you know, and when I first got diagnosed, all I wanted was, I remember praying, there you go. I remember praying, please, just give me 10 more years, you know. Mm. And then 10 years are up now, and you're kind of saying, okay, I know I only asked for 10, but you couldn't throw another 10 in there, would you?
Who are you praying to?
I don't know. Well, your spirit, you know, I had a friend, a Sioux Indian, and they just believed that each life was like a lesson to be learned. The more lessons you learned, the nearer you got to nirvana, until you became part of God. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was the way. And I liked that kind of philosophy.
You mentioned your mother and father there. They and we've talked about them before.
Yeah.
Remarkable people.
Yeah, Theo Gray. You know, they think a lot about me, especially now that I'm coming kind of towards the end. Like my dad worked in CIA as an upholsterer, and he reared 8 of us on a wage, do you know what I mean? I wonder, how did you do that? Yeah. Like, how did you? And, you know, we had nothing. We had absolutely nothing as kids, you know. And yet, they're calling this a recession at the moment. The 80s was a recession, a proper recession, you know. So I remember me dad, I remember even, I left the job. I was in Telecom Ireland. And I felt having that job to fall back on was robbing me of the will to succeed with Aslan. So I said, if I give up the Telecom Ireland job and go full-time at Aslan, I have to make it work, kind of thing. And at the time, it was a pensionable job. I mean, yeah, feckin' easy, you're not giving up a pensionable job. So still, I don't think he ever forgave me for that. But, you know, that's what life is, isn't it? Taking these chances.
Didn't he used to have that lovely, he loved all those old classical records and
that's who introduced me to the beauty of music, you know.
Bel canto.
So by me listening to me dad singing opera music and bel canto, which is probably the pinnacle of singing, you know, it gave me something to kind of to aim at. And the beautiful thing I loved about bel canto was, like, I studied 15 years, but I know now I know less now than I did when I started.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what the beauty of it. You never reach perfection. It's just you learn new things every day.
Do you think about your mother much?
Yeah. It was weird. My mum was weird when she died. My mum died and she kind of died fairly suddenly. And I had to do the obituary and all that carry on. Mm. So, you know, the day of the funeral, and you're running around organising the funeral, and I was writing out the obituary. And I remember not crying at the funeral, or, you know, and I thought, you're a heartless bastard. Your mother's at the dying and you won't cry.
Mm-hmm.
But I was coming home, I was walking the dog one day, and I was just walking up that road. And from the bottom of that road, you can look through. There used to be a church in Fingers. It just got knocked down a couple of months ago. But you could see the steeple of it from here.
Mm.
And I was just walking around. I just watched seeing the steeple. And that was it. That was the end of it. I just opened the floodgates, you know. Because it was, this was the church where we got, you know, where she got buried from and where we made a Holy Communion from and all that.
You were able to grieve then.
Yeah, so then I said, yeah, I just opened the floodgates. Up to that, I thought it no hurt. Honest to God, it was weird.
The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Centre Parks. Explore the woodland and have endless adventures together, whatever the weather.
What would you say was the worst time of your life?
Oh man, millions. I have millions of them. You know, obviously the addiction was a nightmare, you know. I feel terrible sorry for kids now today. It's becoming hopeless. You know what I see happening, Ryan? These kids are seeing how much money they can be made and blah, blah, blah. And it's harder to get them to stop now, you know.
So that was your worst time, was the addiction stuff?
I think so, yeah. I can't think of any worse time than that.
Yeah.
I remember going over to Tamprabok in Thailand and, jeez, it was a nightmare, absolute nightmare. Because you just go over and they'd put you in a lockdown compound, they take all your money off and they give you like monopoly money that only works on the side. And I remember once I was in bed, and when you're coming off drugs, you sweat a lot. So I was kind of half sleeping and I felt like a pool of sweat in the middle of my chest there, rolling down my chest. And I opened my eyes. And I was like a praying mantis eating a butterfly on my chest. And I just thought, man, this is not right. This is not where I should be today, do you know what I mean? Another time, we were in it's just a quick one. We were in meditation, just with these meditations. We'd be all kneeling in front of like a gutter and they give you this drink and about 5 minutes later you start vomiting, like projectile vomiting. And it gets the toxins and all out of you. But that's one of the things. But we're in meditation one day. So we're lying on this big floor and there's no doors in any of the places because it's so warm over there. So there's a monk up the top and he's like, right, from your right ankle to your toes, relaxed. So then he reads slowly. And in the background, you've got kind of monks beating drums. Right, now from your shin to your ankle, to your tip of your toes, relaxed in the right leg. And you go on and on and on. Then you go up to the left side and you're about at the chest. And next minute he's like, get on! Honest to God, when you're in a meditative state, it's like you're in a different place, you know. But this snake had come into the oak, like, it had been about 6 foot long, you know, just slithered into the room. And it slithered in between all of us. We're all just lying on mats, you know, and you think, What?
How did this happen?
Yeah.
And it wasn't a hallucination, it was actually...
Oh, no, this was a king python, no.
That was the darkest time then.
Was dark, yeah.
Let me reverse the question.
Yeah.
When were you happiest?
The happiest moment I ever had in my life was scared of being born. I'll never forget that moment because... And I remember thinking with Ciara, this person existed, had no identity. It was just a bump on Catherine, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And in a nanosecond, you'd kill everybody in the room if you tried to touch that baby, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember the love hit me that quickly, you know, and that suddenly. It nearly knocked me off my feet, nearly knocked me on my arse, do you know what I mean? But that was an amazing feeling. And it's a little bit ironic that when I first got diagnosed, I remember thinking, I didn't care what car I drove. I didn't care where I lived. I didn't care about Aslan. I didn't care about fame. Well, I never did care about fame or any of that shit. The only thing I cared about was seeing my grandkids for a little bit longer, you know. Right? So after thinking about that, I thought, for years I was running around like a blue ass fly, wondering, what's life all about? You know, why are we here? Mm. And I used to take drugs to try and find a way or a pathway to the meaning of life kind of thing. And there it was in front of me all the time. And I took this, you know. One thing great about the cancer is it's great for prioritising it. You know, you just focus in on what's important, you know. And some of the happiest moments I've had have been since I've been diagnosed, you know, because you appreciate things more, you know.
What do you appreciate more?
Appreciate life, just being alive, you know. You wake up in the morning, your feet hit the floor. Like, I'd be here that night, and because it affected my heart, I'd be here that night and you get a little twinge in your heart and you go, oh, this is it. This is it now. This is, you know, and then you wake up the next morning and you go, oh, thanks, that's lovely.
You know, Catherine was saying to me when we came in that she had a dream about feeding you porridge and that you, as a result of the porridge, the dream went on. Part two of the dream was that you were up gigging. Porridge was the answer. And the next day she came down and she fed you porridge to say, maybe this is the answer. And you said to her, do you remember what you said to her about the dream?
I dream about gigging that night as well.
Isn't that amazing?
I gig a lot about, I dream a lot about gigging.
Do you? What's happening in the gigs?
Well, at the moment...
In your dreams, obviously, yeah.
No, while I'm still here, I'm still kind of doing what I'm doing. You said to me on the late one day about Finbar Fury. Remember, I was telling you we are walking with Finbar. So we're at the finishing a couple of songs for the thing. So we've done Grace, the Sally Gardens, Raglan Road, and Greenfields of France.
Greenfields of France, yeah, amazing.
So we're gonna release the Greenfields of France, but we didn't think it was the right time at the moment.
Yes.
So we're gonna go with Grace because of Easter and all that.
It's the new unofficial anthem of Ireland anyway as well.
Yeah. So that's it. So I'm always kind of thinking it.
But it's funny that you're dreaming of gigging as well.
Yeah.
Because it's so ingrained in your DNA, in your brain, in your soul, that it's there in your dream time. And you've always been eating and drinking and sleeping this.
But you have dreams like the gig will be packed and you open your mouth and you forget the words of all the songs or something.
Ah, okay. So that's a nightmare then.
Yeah, it turns out to be a nightmare. But, you know, look, it is what it is. When I look back on my life, I've had a very full life, you know. I've done an awful lot and I've still a little bit more to do. And until my heart stops, I'm going to keep trying to do that, you know. Try and just get the best out or ring every little drop of life that I have.
When you have the moments that you described a minute ago about the twitch of the heart and you're
it's
3 o'clock in the morning and you're sitting or lying on the bed here in your front room and you think, this is it. What's the next bit in your thought? This is it. What?
So you're thinking, like, this is it. You're going to die. And it's terrifying. Like, I've never... The fear, I remember... I never felt fear. Like, I remember I flatlined when I was in Blanchardstown Hospital. So they kind of brought me back and it's all anaesthetists and all around trying to get my heart beating properly. They couldn't get the beats back up again. Mm. And there's a nurse holding my hand and she's kind of rubbing my hand as they were doing all their work. And I said, I'm not going to die, am I? And she just looked away. She didn't kind of go, no, you're not, you'll be grand. And that, I'll never forget that fear. It was just horrific, honest to God, absolutely horrific.
What were you afraid of?
I don't know. It's the unknown, I suppose. You know, and this is the end and I'll never see my grandkids again and I'll never see Catherine again and just things like that, you know.
Where does that bring you?
That brings you to hell. Because it's hard to explain.
Well, do you do, young Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while, neath the warm summer sun? I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I can see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the Great Falling in 1916. Well, I hope you died well and I hope you died clean, young Willie McBride. Was it slow and obscene? Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife lowly? Did he sound the dead march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did you leave her a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some fateful heart is your memory enshrined? Although you died back in 1916, and that fateful heart, are you forever 19?
Or are you a stranger without even a name, enclosed down forever behind a glass pane? On an old photograph, torn, battered and stained, and faded to yellow in a brown leather frame. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the dead march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest?
The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1.
This is going to sound like an odd question, but I'm still stuck with the guy walking by the window.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to know how...
Because, they see, the guy passing the window was just symbolic. And then I thought, you'll never do that again.
Yeah.
You'll never sing again. You'll never feel that feeling, you know, in Vicar Street where it's jammed, you know what I mean? And people are really singing along, you know, because there's no feeling on earth like somebody singing their songs back to you, you know, when you're singing, we're doing a gig and I break the song down and get the audience to sing. That feeling is amazing, you know. So it just goes, it brings you into that spiral.
Yes.
And then you start going and it just gets really negative. And it's hard to get out of it.
I suppose I'm trying to figure out that if something remarkable happened, miraculous happened, and the doctors came in and said, don't know what happened there, Christy, but you're clear, you're good to go.
Yeah.
What would you do?
I don't know. I'd strip off naked and I'd run up and down that street about 20 times. I don't know, Ryan. It's a weird one, you know.
Well, think about it for a second. What? How would you recalibrate your life? I mean, it's probably a cruel question in some
ways. I think, no, not really.
Let's play the game for a moment.
Yeah, all of the reality that the diagnosis brought to my, you know, way of thinking will still be there, you know. So you'll have all that focus and all that prioritising, but you'll have your health with it. You know, it's youth is too good to be wasted on the young kind of thing.
Yeah.
But if you're old and have all the health to be able to do all the things, like I sit here and I'm looking at an ad And it's all, it's all, every second that now is about cremations. We can cremate you for 1,100 euro. And it's just, oh, come on. It's like somebody up there just doing it to annoy me. Honest to God.
But you'd after you'd finished streaking for the neighbours 20 times in a row, you'd have a different pair of eyes on the world. And
absolutely,
I just think a lot of people who would be listening to our conversation would be going, I never see the world through the prism of not ever being allowed to have it. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, and you know, I think unless you've gone through something like this, you never will. You know.
Let's get on to nicer stories and talk about Catherine.
Yeah, well, I said this before and I say it again. She's a very lucky girl. And I've made loads of dodgy decisions in my life, you know. Mm-hmm. Loads of mistakes I've made. And I don't regret them because I'm happy where I'm at now, you know. And if I had to go through that to arrive here, I'm quite happy with that. But one decision I feel I won the lotto was when I kind of met Catherine, you know.
Why?
Because there was times when, first of all, at the start of Aslan, we went over to Australia. I said this on the late night. Went over to Australia and we loved her over there. We were only 21, I think. And I said, look, we'll go back to Ireland. We'll do Aslan for a year and then we'll come back here, get married, come back here and rear our kids and blah, blah, blah. And that was 40 years ago. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So she... When we got back, she said, she's a hairdresser. She said, look, I'll take care of the bills. You go, you know, full time. Just before I was working telecom, she says, you go full time with the band and we just see how it goes. So she's always supported me in that way. She used to come around putting up posters with us and stuff, you know. And she's still there, you know. It's weird. You meet all these people through your life who you think are friends and stuff. And there's a lot of bullshit out there. You have family and, you know, family is what it's really about. But a true friend is like gold dust, like hen's teeth. A really true friend, you know.
She protects you.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely she does, yeah.
I mean, as I say, she protects you, I realise who I'm saying that to and the song.
Yeah.
I didn't mean it like that. I wasn't trying to be funny, actually.
But no, she does protect
you. Isn't it funny that's the word
she's
that
like
came to mind?
She's like a buffer to the world for me,
yeah.
You know.
And yeah.
It's amazing to have somebody that you know, you love enough and you trust enough. There's nothing she'd do to hurt me, do you know what I mean?
Do you think that in the event of things ending the way they probably will for us all, but for yourself, do you think Catherine is aware of the depth of that love?
Ah, yes, I hope so.
You're looking at her now, smiling.
She better be. One of the things I wanted to do as well.
Yeah.
If I was looking down from if there was a heaven, I would dearly love Ciara to carry me legacy, you know. Because if there's anybody on earth has a right to sing those songs, it would be her, do you know what I mean? So that's a big vibe with me, you know.
You want Ciara to continue her dad's story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sing the songs.
Yeah. In some ways, she's been unlucky being my daughter because people think, that's because she's Christy Dignam's daughter. But she has a real talent, you know, and I wouldn't say that and have people going out making a show of herself, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She has a real talent and, you know, a lot of the stuff would be written around, you know, as you were growing up and stuff like that. So she's the only person on earth would have the right to do it in that way, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, on the wall here you have a letter from...
From Mick?
Mick, you call him Mick. We call him President Higgins. You know, yours. But he says he wants to thank you for all you've contributed to the cultural life of our nation.
And that blew me away, that is.
He says, I join with your many loyal fans in wishing you a speedy recovery. And may I say how much all music lovers look forward to Aslan's much-anticipated 4th anniversary performance. That was sent in November 2022. Yeah, that's a letter from the first citizen of the country, but you know, we know from the radio programme, from the TV show, the amount of love that's come in for you by way of email,
so
letter,
shocked.
Text. Really unbelievable.
I'm still humbled by it, you know. Like, your reaction has been absolutely amazing. And that's another reason why I wanted to do this. I wanted this opportunity to thank all those people, because I never really got a chance to do it, to thank all those people who stood by me and who helped give me a great life. And it's been an absolute pleasure doing it with them, you know.
Incredible amount of love out there for you, I can tell you.
And I'll tell you another thing. If you ask me, would I rather be successful on a world stage and hated in Ireland or loved in Ireland and not give a shit about in the international stage, I wouldn't swap it for anything in the world.
Well, you've achieved that.
Yeah.
Just as we finish off our chat, we're in this room and I have to say, I was expecting somebody who was not as well as you appear to be today, in the sense that you look great. You've got the hoodie on, you've got the chain and the bracelet on, you've got the glasses on, the hair's good. Now, I don't know, the fact you're married to a hairdresser, that probably helps matters.
I was terrified during this interview, I swear to God.
Were you?
Absolutely.
Why?
I don't know. It was just, you know, it's like your first and your last, you know what I mean? You start off, you kind of, just the first time on the Late Late Show. But you don't want to be going on saying, oh, this is my last time on the Late Late Show. Do you know what I mean? It's stuff like that. So since I've been diagnosed, within the last year or so, everything I do was, I'd kind of try and absorb a bit of it, because this could be the last time you do this, you know. And
do you think this is going to be our last time meeting?
You know, here's a bit of irony for you. When I got diagnosed in 2013, the manager got killed in a fire down in Norway, right?
Mm.
Fitzy, a keyboard player, had a knot in his gut. I mean, they opened him up to look at it. He found cancer on his liver. And he passed away. And then the girl that did all our social media was in a fire down in Galway. And she was killed. So the point I'm making is, if you'd have said at the beginning of that year, one of you are going to die in the Elsline organisation this year, my hand would have been the first up, you know, of course it's going to be me. Yeah, I'm still here. And do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's no life, rhyme or reason to it, is there?
Life is peculiar.
What are you doing to stop going out of your mind with boredom?
Well, I love football. I'm obsessed with football. Big Celtic man.
Yeah.
So
Grace is
can I tell you
there.
A funny story about
Yeah, of course
Celtic.
You can.
We were playing a place down in Cork. So after the gig, the manager said to me, listen, the owner wants to meet you. And I'm like, oh, I want to go home. I'll be here all bleeding night, you know. So I says, right, look, I'll go in and meet him after the gig for 10 minutes. I said, but you come in 10 minutes and say, come on, you have to go, right? So I'm talking to him and he's saying, he was born and reared in a council estate in Cork. He says, and in 1985, he left Cork with £200 in his pocket, and his mother kind of crying on the dock kind of thing, and off he went, and he lived in Scotland for the rest since then. So he's saying he kind of never heard of Aslan from Ireland. He learned of us through Scotland, do you know what I mean? But he says, and now he says, I own 12% of Celtic Football Club. I was like a limpet, stuck onto his back. You couldn't get rid of me.
You're so superficial, Christy.
Oh, I know, absolutely. But he flew us over then for one of the Rangers games in a private jet.
There you go.
Brilliant.
Your 10-minute conversation became a friendship for life.
So sometimes it can be good.
And I see you're reading a little bit here. You've got Rebel Sisters by Marita Conlon McKenna and 16 Lives. You've got Joseph Plunkett, here we are again.
Yeah.
From Honour, Brullicon. And that's, as we're here on, Easter just gone by, but you're a proud Irishman, aren't you?
Absolutely love being Irish.
Yeah. Have you thought about your funeral? Do you care? And does it matter to you?
I'd rather just die. David Bowie is the best funeral ever.
What was that?
You just die and get cremated and that's it. Nobody knew where it was, who it was. Do you know what I mean? And he was just gone. And that's it, just a little puff of smoke. You know, that's the way I like it. Because I don't want to be sitting in there seeing everybody. It's always freezing.
At the wake?
Yeah.
He's freezing.
I don't like that shit, you know.
Are you happy, are you sad, are you scared?
I'm happy. And I get very sad and I get very scared. Like, you know, the thing about with this diagnosis, anybody with cancer. That's the way I used to love listening to Vicky Phelan and that. Yeah. Because when you do get into a particular emotion, you get into it, you know what I mean? You don't do it by halves. Do you know what I mean? Because everything is so serious. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And there's no time for bullshit.
Do you feel minded and loved?
Yeah. Within the family unit. And then again, you know, I hate calling using the word fans because it's a real, I think it's a very condescending word. But let's say supporters of the, you know, Aslan and stuff like that. There's great, I grew up very insecure about myself, you know, real, I was very vulnerable and, you know, and to be, it's like an acceptance almost. Mm. And that's why I think I became who I became, because every night you're going out trying to prove, you know, get people's approval, you know. Mm. So that was a huge sense of satisfaction for me, the response I got from the public when they announced, you know, that I probably wouldn't be gigging anymore, you know.
Would you like to say anything else before we say goodbye?
I love you.
I love you too, man.
No, I think we got through it all there. It's just...
Every time you came into any radio show or TV show I've always looked forward to your company.
Same here, yeah.
Because you're a devil.
That's why I wanted you, because I was thinking, how will I get to do this? Because I haven't done anything, you know, over a couple of years, you know, and I was saying, so who will I get to if I am there? And you're the first person that came into my mind, you know.
Well, to invite us into your house like you have today is a real privilege for us, because this is your private place, you know.
Yeah.
And I hope people listening in their cars or wherever they are in the world feel that they were in the room with us today.
Yeah.
Listening to you talking so freely and animatedly and excitedly and sometimes sadly about life and the universe, because you're always so engaging. So smart, so astute, so talented. All the things you won't let me say to you to your face, but I'm going to say them anyway. But thanks to you and Catherine for letting us here today. And as I keep saying to you, every time I meet you, see you next time.
Yeah, God knows. Yeah. If there's a nuclear war, it'd be just me and cockroaches left, as I said before.
Christy Dignam, you're some man for one man. Mind yourself and we'll see you along the road.
You too, Ryan. It's great talking to you.
The moment I foresaw your face, my love, that night I couldn't sleep or close my eyes. A picture stayed inside my mind, my love, and when I woke, I felt you near. See, I was captured by your smile, my love, and in your eyes I saw eternity. To be so lost and then to find my love, the very one that's meant for me. And when we walk down Grafton Street, I held your hand as you leaned into me. I could hardly catch my breath. I could hardly speak a word to you. And all that I'd have said is that I've fallen deep. When we walk down could hardly catch my breath. I could hardly speak a word to you. And all that I have said is that I've fallen deeply in love with you.
So we're at 5 to 10 now, and you've been listening to my chat with Christy Dignam. Wishing Christy a very good morning, by the way, and Catherine, and want to say a huge thank you for inviting us into their home, and to Christy for just being so open and honest. As you've heard, the response by text is phenomenal, to say the least. There is so much love for Christy there this morning, so we'll try and get it. Hopefully he might be listening, but... certainly to give him a sense of it. We'll read some of them now and maybe even read some tomorrow. But thanks to Siobhan Hawk and Damien Chanels on sound, and Siobhan who put it all together. Appreciate that very much, because there was a lot there to take in. And as you can appreciate, we were all probably just processing it because he was so, insightful. Well, just to say, says Margaret Christie, you are a great ordinary Irish gentleman in this crazy world, wishing you all the best. I mean, I don't even know where to begin with these messages. I'm in bits here, Ryan, and my husband died 3 years ago and there was so much left undone and unsaid. May the Lord bless you, Christy, and may the road rise to meet you. Thank you for this interview, says Anne. Love him, and it makes me take account, so it's good for us all. The tears have started with the green fields of France, an amazing voice, superb interview, and... brilliant. Wishing Christy and his family great peace. Listening to Christy, what a hero, says Mary. I particularly want to thank him for showing the horror of drug addiction. His story shows a wonderful man who has come through with great resilience and bravery. Wish him peace and love. And the songs we played, that lovely song at the end is called Song for Catherine, which is from Christy's solo album, The Man Who Stayed Alive. And then you probably heard in the middle of it, The Green Fields of France. That's been viewed millions of times, I think, on YouTube, which he was the Late Late Show appearance in 2017, January 2017, and Christy and Finbar Fury together on the couch. I'll never forget it because I sat in at the dress rehearsal, and as they were rehearsing it, I just thought, we are seeing something special here, and right enough, people reacted as you'd appreciate. Thank you. Great stuff this morning. Heart's broken here listening to my legend. Keep rocking, Christy, from Henry in Wicklow Town. Wonderful. We love you, Christy. I mean, that's from Thomas in Berlin in Germany. And just wow. See you down the road. That's the truth. What a wonderful and brave interview with Christy. I'd like to thank him for sharing his soul with us, as well as his music, and sending him much love and prayers from Galway. And that's from Jeanette Hines. Thank you for a heartfelt interview with Christy. Always loved him in Aslan. He's so normal and down to earth. Wish him well, and he will always be remembered by the people of Ireland for his amazing music. And Aslan closed the Leakslip Festival years ago. They were amazing, says Teresa. Amazing interview with an amazing man, Christy, a true legend in every way, says Carmel in Killiney. And nice, amazing. That's Tim, very good. And on the go, wonderful memories of Aslan when they played in the Vic in Tramore, the performance Christie gave there, the performances were amazing. The energy he gave was unreal in bare feet and leather trousers. Kind wishes and thank you to Christie. What a man he is, and his legacy he will leave behind to so very brave to do that and to be so open, wishing him nothing but the best. So it's just that kind of thing. And thank you for those. I'll just go one more because it's bizarre but brilliant. Patricia says, I've a beautiful christening robe that was made by Christie's grandmother, Teasy, and it was gifted to me by my children's great-grandmother, Mary Moore, who lived in Cabra. It's been used by my two children for their christenings and in recent years, five grandchildren. It'll go on for many generations to come. So Christie's memory will be with my family for a long, long time. So thinking of Christie and his family at this difficult time, and thanks for the great music and the memories, Christie. Well, thank you indeed, and we're sending all our love to Christie and Catherine and Kira and the whole family this morning.